I'd like to begin all of these conferences with some prayer. The best way to do that is to consciously put ourselves in the presence of God and to ask Him to be with us. Let us just silently be with our best friend for a few moments. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Since some of us have gotten sober, alcoholism has not gotten any prettier. Most alcoholics die terrible deaths. And usually the last 10 or 20 years of their life is spent in confusion, disillusionment, all kinds of misplaced blame and anger. Alcoholism is not a very pretty thing, but recovery can be. And recovery is an ongoing process. And it's something that you and I can not only participate in the sense of being recipients of that, but we can become part of recovery in the sense of helping that happen for other people. And it involves a lot of open-mindedness on our part. A characteristic of alcoholics that's been noted for a long time by non-alcoholics who study our behavior is that we're very rigid. Now, I can think of a lot of things I wouldn't mind being called, but rigid's not on the list. You know, I'm flexible, damn it. And you can hear the rigidity in that kind of a statement. You get rigid because you get driven down on the low end of that feeling chart, and when you're in a lot of pain, you only have time to come up with one solution or one option to anything. And if you're still drinking, that solution is always to drink. So that's where the rigidity comes from. The sign of a mature person is someone who can consider a whole lot of different options or solutions to something without getting emotionally attached to any one of them before you look at all of them. Now, I don't understand that at all, but I think it's a nice goal to have off there in the distance somewhere to aim toward it. And I can handle two pretty well right now, but I'm already prejudiced towards one of them by the time I'm thinking of the second one. Prayer is an important part of recovery. A lot of people don't know much about prayer. Something I hear as a priest consistently is, gee, wish I knew how to pray. Could you teach me a little more about that? I'm not happy with my prayer life. Well, there was a time when I studied a lot of the spiritual masters, both in the Christian tradition and others, and they all seem to have some common themes that run throughout their writings and their lives, and one of them is that they all chronically complain about their prayer life. So you're in real good company. You know, the disciples at one time said, Lord, teach us how to pray. And that's where we got the so-called Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it constantly refers us to prayer and meditation. In the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, when it comes to step 11, it uses as an example the Peace Prayer of St. Francis as a prayer that you could use that's been written by someone else to meditate on and to integrate some of the ideas in your life. I happen to really care a great deal about that particular prayer, and I'll pray it with you here in a moment. Two of the reasons why I like the prayer so much is I happen to be a Franciscan. And that may not mean too much to anybody, but St. Francis, or Francis of Assisi, lived in Italy about 800 years ago. And he was primarily interested in doing God's will, so much so that he did a lot of things that were very unconventional. I think that's why I like him. His father was a wealthy cloth merchant in that town and went away one day and left Francis in charge. And Francis gave a lot of the expensive cloth to poor people. That upset his dad, the neighborhood, the whole town. They had something to talk about. And on one particular occasion, Francis decided to completely sever his relationship with his father, who only wanted him to be socially acceptable in the heir to his business and a good businessman. And his father called the bishop to discipline him. So right in the middle, in the town square, right in front of the bishop and his dad, Francis took off all his clothes and gave them back to his dad and said, "Thanks for everything, but I'll start over." Just imagine somebody doing that today. The common joke among Franciscans is that if Francis applied to be part of our group, he'd never get through the screening process today. Psychologically unfit. And I had the happy occasion a few years ago to spend 6 months or 6 weeks in Italy studying the life of Francis. And what I learned that I didn't already know is he had even a more incredible love of nature than I thought he had before. Because all the little places that he picked to live and to visit were just the garden spots of Italy. A lot of them kind of tucked out of the way, but he really had an eye for that. And nature, believe it or not, has a lot to do with spirituality. There's a long-standing tradition among spiritual authors about just slowing down and appreciating nature. And if you live in Arizona, you live in a place where when God created it, he was showing off. I mean, go visit Missouri someday, or, you know, then you'll know. There are a lot of places that you can get gratitude for living in Arizona. There's a small book that's out of print called 12. And 12 was written anonymously by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who gave his impression of the 12 steps the first time he heard them, what they meant to him, a year later, 5 years later, and then so many years after that. I forget what it was. And like a typical alcoholic, by the time he gets to about step four, he forgets his method and the whole thing gets all jumbled up and you can't figure out what year he's on. But there's a lot of real powerful wisdom in that little book. I hope you run across it someday. I'd like to pass two of the things that I found there along to you that I found helpful. One is, he was doing inventory and he realized or had a strong suspicion that underlying some of his character defects there was a more common one. And he tried to find out what that was. In other words, there was a character defect that gave birth to a lot of the others. And in spiritual traditions, I don't know if he knew this language or not, that's often called a person's predominant fault. And people are often encouraged to try to discover what the predominant fault is. For some of us, it's anger. For some of us, it's laziness. For some of us, it's pride. For some of us, it's being overly sensitive. Let me finish that story before I forget the sensitive part. I have a wonderful friend that I talked to recently. He used to live here in town. He and his wife are program. John's the alcoholic, and Maggie's the Al-Anon. A lot of you here know John and Maggie that moved back to Baltimore. John has a great story. Before he knew he was an alcoholic, he too thought he was crazy, and he was a very highly successful advertising person on Madison Avenue, and he had a bunch of books. And he thought he was crazy, so he went to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist he went to twice a week for 3 years. And this is one of those high-priced guys, you know, one of the $90, $100 an hour types. So you can just figure up the dollars that he spent with this guy. And John said, John's a very outspoken, grandiose, type of person who talks a lot. And he said it was a perfect match because the psychiatrist was a Rogerian from the, what do you call that technique?
Freud.
Where you just, no, it's not Freud, it's where you just kind of listen. Yeah, non-directive therapist. So really all the therapist did was reflect back to John what he said. He said, "Oh, I see what you mean. You think that," and he'd say what John said back to him. And he'd grunt a lot and say, "Mm-hmm, I see." And he played right into John's hand because John did all the talking. Anyway, John said one day he had a session that made all of the money that he spent over those 3 years worthwhile and a bargain. He said it because it was the only time that that psychiatrist ever made a direct statement. John came bursting into his office this morning, and I'm telling you this because there's an application to each of us here, I think. Came bursting into the guy's office. He says, "Doc, I finally see my underlying problem. There's something under all this stuff we've been talking about that really explains all of it. And that's what we ought to be working on. And the psychiatrist said, John, you finally found your underlying problem. John says, yeah, I think I have. And the psychiatrist says, well, what's that? John says, I found out that I'm just sensitive. And the psychiatrist got up out of his chair, which he'd never done before, and walked around in front of the desk, and he put his hand on John, and he said, John, great artists are sensitive. Painters, sculptors, musicians. You're just touchy. Now, it's worth a lot of money to find that out. You know? Now, our friend who wrote the book 12, in trying to discover what his underlying character defect or predominant fault was, came up with this one that I never heard before, but I think's a beaut. And it's called unrealistic expectations. We decide ahead of time how things are going to work out, what's going to happen, and how everyone else is going to react to it. And it doesn't happen that way. Unrealistic expectations. The other thing that I found so valuable, and what reminded me of it, was Sedona this morning talking about that. In the back, he has what he calls a 24-hour plan. And he says, what you need to do if you want to live a day at a time is to find out what a day is. So the way you discover what a day is you go out in nature somewhere by yourself and you kind of set up camp. And if you're not the campy type or you don't like sleeping bags or tents or things like that, you get a little cabin, but you get out there by yourself. And you just spend the whole day without reading a book, without writing anything down. You just sit there. And I've done that. I do it about every 6 months. It's one of the most healing things that... The first time I did it, about, you know, because I got there the night before and I slept out up in Sedona, up in the hills, and I woke up just a little bit before dawn, and that was all kind of neat, and I had a little bit of breakfast, but by 9:30, I was going crazy because nothing was happening. And then all of a sudden, it's 11 o'clock, and by this time, I've discovered all kinds of little bugs, and the shadows on the leaves are a little different, and boy, then it speeds up. It doesn't go too fast, but before you know it, the sun is about to set, and you watch that, and then the stars start to come out, and something happens to you internally. You get in sympathy with the rhythm of nature, and it is healing, it's enlightening, it's restful. And I can live off that for a good 6 months. And there's no logical agenda with it. You know, I kept wanting to check every hour to see if I was doing it right. But anymore, it helps you just let go. And I recommend that to anybody. I'm glad I'm talking about it. I need to do it. It's been a while. But it just seems right. The closest words I've ever heard that express that, well, I once saw a poster, a photograph of an old grizzled Indian chief, and there was a quotation from him printed on the bottom of the poster, and it simply said, "The earth and I are of one mind." Now, there's a lot to be said for that, particularly those of us who are inundated with noise and busyness. Because if you just slow down that way, besides appreciating and getting in tune with the nature outside of you, you get in tune and you're able to hear the nature inside of you that has had too weak a voice to be heard before then. Anyway, this beautiful peace prayer of St. Francis, I like because Francis liked nature so much. The other reason I like it is the whole thing is phrased in paradoxes and in opposites. And Alcoholics Anonymous is like that. I'm convinced the spiritual life is very, very paradoxical. There are three editions of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. What's different about the three editions are the stories in the back. They add some or they drop some. For example, the one in the present edition, Doctor, Addict, Alcoholic, is new. By the way, I was with him, Paul, a couple of weeks ago, and he's moved back to the L.A. area and wanted to be remembered to his Phoenix friends. Anyway, that story is in the present edition. But the one they dropped out of the second edition was called The Professor and the Paradox. And a paradox is something that seemingly is self-contradictory, or it appears as though it wouldn't work, but it works in the backwards kind of way. And he lists four. I didn't know I was going to talk about this, so I may not remember them all, but we suffer to get well. We die to live. We give away to keep. What's the fourth one?
Surrender
to win. Thank you. Yeah. Those are all spiritual truths that are very valid. You're going to have a hard time selling it out there in the mall this afternoon. But, give away to keep. Try that one with your banker. Anyway, the spiritual life is paradoxical, and this prayer has a lot to do with that. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Let me just say something about that word sow. It's S-O-W. It was written at a time in an agrarian culture where people planted things and knew about things growing. So it's like sowing seeds. So where there is hatred, let me sprinkle a little love around and hope it grows, that kind of an idea. Let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. And where there is darkness, life. Where there is sadness, joy. Now the paradoxical part. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen. Earlier in the retreat, I mentioned something about a basic fault that many of us have is playing God. And part of the reason why we blow that so bad is when we play God, we get so serious. And everything is of cosmic importance. I mean, some of you know they've moved the Alamo Club in Scottsdale recently. It's fun to listen to the conversation about that. Yeah. But, the implications are all related to salvation and damnation and survival. Anyway. Part of this letting go that Al-Anons talk about has to do with loosening up. Have you ever noticed how healing the humor is in Alcoholics Anonymous? I think of the traditions that they printed up that save us our unity. The one that they could have left out is that we ought never to be organized. I don't think they ever have to worry about about this group getting organized. So every time I hear that, I kind of have to laugh, you know? There's a lot of levity in program. There's a lot of levity in healthy program. And there's a lot of, I'm not sure I know the word, there's a lot of, disrespect would be too strong a word. Naughty would be too strong a word. Mischievous. There's a lot of healthy mischievous in living. For example, when I got pulled out of the ditch by the elephant and finally realized that I wasn't an alcoholic that night, the man that I called for help was someone that a lot of you know, Larry, Brother Lawrence, Leo Hogan, who lived in Tucson at that time. And he's the guy that got me lined up with Les and some other people up here. And he's a wonderful guy, but he had a twinkle in his eye. And he was part con artist all the time. He used to pray that way, you know, God, have I got a deal for you? You know. he was really great. Anyway, he lived here with me for a couple of years. And toward the end of his life, he had cancer, and he was dying, and he was down at the Little Sisters of the Poor. And I'd always been embarrassed because we didn't have an AA meeting here. You know, I go to every church up and down the street because they have them there, but we never had one here. So we founded a group. We started it. It meets 5 o'clock on Sundays. If you hang around tomorrow, you can go to it. Anyway, today, thanks. Anyway, Larry was alive while we had the first three meetings. You know, so as soon as the meeting would be over, we'd run down there and tell him who was at the meeting, and he'd approve or disapprove of the list. And he was part of it in that way, and it was wonderful. And And just before he died, I told him, I said, you know, we haven't had a group conscience meeting yet, but we know that you can't name, his name was Larry Hogan, you can't name a group after a person today. The central office or GSO has some kind of a guideline for that. But so, we'll find a way to make that meeting a memorial to you. Maybe we'll call it the Love and Hope Group. We'll use your initials, LH, you know, Leo Hogan. So he was really pleased with that. Then he died, and we had our first group conscious meeting, and I brought up this brilliant idea that I thought was so great to call it the Love and Hope Group. And somebody else said, well, you know, we really want to tie it in with Larry, and we can't call it the Larry Hogan Group. Let's call it Hogan's Heroes. So we slipped that one by central office downtown, and I think they think it has something to do with a TV show or something like that. But anyway, 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoons, Hogan's Heroes is here. The point I'm making, whatever is behind that little sneakiness, we pulled one over on them, we got away with something. Whatever that is, it's healthy. You know, if you follow all the rules literally, black and white all day long, you're really boring. Something else I've threatened to do for a long time. You know how people flip out and go into orbit because around some of our meetings we have some literature that's not conference approved? You've heard all that kind of stuff. I want to type up a little pamphlet. We got a pretty good print shop next door. I want to type up a little pamphlet to talk about the pernicious evil of non-conference approved literature, and I'm sure I can come up with a lot of neat ideas. But the hook, and you know, there'll be some people who will eat that stuff up and make a campaign out. But the laugh's on them because that little pamphlet won't be conference approved. Anyway. Whatever it is I'm talking about, you understand, I'm sure. And if there isn't much of that going on in your life, you know, find some. Follow somebody around who's doing it. Because we need to let go of the seriousness. We need to lighten up a little bit. When I was a young boy, I think I was about 8 years old, I saved up 2 or 3 quarters and sent them away to somewhere a long, long ways away with a couple of box tops. And I think it was Battle Creek, Michigan, where I sent it. But anyway, I waited. You too? I waited 3 or 4 months, and then this little cardboard box came in the mail, and it had my name on it, you know, just like a big person typed. And I was so excited, and I opened that up, and there was my secret decoder ring. And my credentials is Dick Tracy's secret agent number 28. Now, at that time, I was so delighted to be Dick Tracy's secret agent number 28, I decided that 28 was going to be my lucky number, and that was going to be my favorite number. And I still get excited when I see 28. Those of you on the way to Tucson, out around Cortero, you'll see a sign 28 miles to Tucson. I go nuts every time I see it. Yeah, right. Some of you live in Prescott. Out toward Yarnell, there's a sign coming toward Prescott. Prescott, 28 miles. Even if they're, I see 28 in the middle of a bunch of other numbers, it kind of jumps out at me. Now, that's part of my life. The other part of it related to that you don't know is, that's probably the biggest thing that ever happened to me up until that time in my life, being Dick Tracy's secret agent. The problem with being 8 or 9 years old and being Dick Tracy's secret agent and being full of that importance is, if you're going to be a good secret agent, you can't tell anybody. Because you'll blow your cover. So here I am just bursting with this new identity that I have and nowhere to go with it. Well, everything was okay and I was doing fine until about 2 weeks later. And I was a real good secret agent because I discovered that there were other secret agents in my class, in my school. They weren't as good as I was because I found out who they were. The crushing blow was when I found out they were all secret agent number 28. Now, I don't think I've recovered from that yet. There's still a lingering resentment. And I was betrayed, I was devastated because, you know, adults shouldn't lie to kids. And they were so damn cheap, they didn't even do serial numbers for the secret agents, you know. And they were really fudging. They created the impression that we were all special and we weren't. And, you know, if you can't trust Dick Tracy, what's left? Huh? You know how much this peace prayer means to me. Both being a Franciscan and also being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it's used as the model prayer to meditate on and think about and learn from. When I was in Italy studying the life of Francis, one of the things that I learned over there that was as painful as Secret Agent number 28 is that Francis never saw this prayer. It was written about 150 years ago in Germany. A group of Franciscans were going to have a convention. They printed up a little program and they had a blank page on the back, and someone said, "Why don't we put a prayer there?" And somebody looked up a lot of scripture quotations and shuffled them together and called it Francis's prayer, and that's where it came from. Betrayed again. First by Dick Tracy, now by Francis, Franciscans, and God. Yeah. There's a point I'm making here. I think it was 3 years ago that I had hepatitis. I've never been that sick in my life. And it wasn't the kind of sick that hurt. It was just no energy. You know, if you had a thought that day, it was a big deal. You know, able to go to the bathroom by yourself, it was worth writing a letter about if you could ever write again. Anyway, that lasted about 6 weeks while I was quarantined and just flat on my back. And prior to that, Father Lambert, who's on the staff here, he's a quiet little German guy who's got a lot of spiritual wisdom to him. So if you ever really need someone like that, look up Lambert. He's shy, he's bashful, hard to get started with him, but once you get him going, there's a wealth of wonderful wisdom there. Anyway, that same summer, Lambert wanted to go to Tucson for a couple of months and stay at the prayer house down there. And he had his heart set on that. And he left. And I knew how much he wanted to do that. That's out by the retreat house, Picture Rocks. It's across the road from there. And Lambert came back. And he was walking around. By this time, I was well enough to sit out in the patio and kind of sun myself. And lo and behold, Lambert comes around the corner. We're thrilled to see each other, and he heard that I was contagious, but he didn't want to get too close, so we're standing out there in the backyard yelling at each other, "Hi, how are you?" And I said, "How was Tucson?" And he said, "Well, it didn't work out the way I thought it would. But then nothing ever does." And maybe it was because I was so slow at that time, but that seemed like profound wisdom. Nothing ever does. And as soon as he left, I ran in the kitchen and wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it. Nothing ever works out the way we think we're going to do it. And I started inventorying my life. And in my life, nothing has ever worked out the way I thought it was going. I don't know about yours. Maybe some of you get to have something your way once in a while. But it hasn't worked that way with me. And I'm so happy Lambert said that. You know, didn't work out the way I thought it would, but then nothing ever does. Now that speaks to those of you who, like me, have a character defect called unrealistic expectations. In Scott Peck's language, life is difficult. Once we accept the fact that life is difficult, it isn't so difficult anymore. If those of us who look at our history and discover that nothing has worked out the way we thought it would, or at least very few things, then we can expect in the future not to have everything work out our way. And we're not going to be so terminally suicidal or thrown every time something happens that we didn't plan on. Because the living life ahead of time is called playing God. That's apparently God doesn't have a sense of time. You know, past, present, future are the same for him. And we try to cram it all together sometimes and it doesn't work. So life is full of disappointments, full of reversals. But there's probably nothing more resilient than a human being. There's hardly anything more resilient than a child if you watch them. And yet some of us, in our attempt to be adult and mature, have in fact instead become very serious and very rigid and very unflexible and unforgiving and unloving and on the live. If sobriety is anything, it should be lively. So the very cliche that I had the most trouble with when I first came, you know, live a day at a time, I thought, my God, these people are retarded. They don't understand. I don't ever want to drink again. Who wants to fuss around with a day? Then I finally saw the wisdom of that. All I have to do is live a day at a time. That's really wonderful compared to what I was trying to do. Live a whole life ahead of time. Plus catch up with the past. You know, revise history. I don't trust history anyway, because it's the winners that write history. Have you ever noticed? Those are the guys that survive. So it's all colored according to their side. Well, we're talking about winners. People who belong to more than one program are referred to as double winners. But if you really realize what qualifies you for more than one program, you'll soon realize that those of us who are double winners are actually double losers. Because we're powerless in more than one category. And there's the paradox again. You know, to lose in the sense of being aware of our powerlessness and our unmanageability is really to win. And try selling that one to an efficiency expert. You know, they're just not going to go for that. Something I always try to work into these retreats, because I found it so helpful for myself, and apparently other people do too, is to talk about guilt. A lot of us feel guilty for a lot of things that aren't our doing. So in the past, I always made a difference between guilt and guilt feelings. And there's a pretty good book about it, too, that is entitled Goodbye to Guilt by Jem Paulski, same guy that wrote Love is Letting Go of Fear. I'll leave this up here. You want to take a look at it. If you just read the front cover, it's worth the price. Goodbye to Guilt. Yeah, I'd like to say goodbye to guilt. Releasing Fear Through Forgiveness. That's his method. Anyway, I won't talk about the book. I'll talk about some other things. Guilt has to do with behavior. If you break a law, you violate a principle, you go against a value of your own, you are guilty of having broken that law or gone against that value or whatever. And usually what happens in a well-adjusted person is when they are guilty of something, they feel guilty. There's a feeling called guilt. The problem with most recovering people is, for whatever reason, or really for many, many different reasons, we can have guilt feelings without being guilty. We just feel terribly guilty about whatever it is. You know, it rained today. God, I feel guilty about that. You say it out loud, you realize how ridiculous it is. That's someone else's department. Huh? So the example I've used, and for those of you that heard it before, I apologize for not having a new example, but let's just pretend that we all work for Sherwin over here. He's our boss, and he's impossible. I don't know if that part's pretending or not. Anyway, so that whenever we get together at a coffee break or something, we badmouth the boss. You know, there's no way to please that guy. Comes up with a whole new set of rules. We change everything. We try to do it that way. By the time we get the job done, he's changed the rules again, and we're at fault. You know, so he's vindictive. He's just hard to live with and work with. And one day, as I'm driving home, there I see Sherwin jaywalking. Aha! I can recognize an opportunity, so I tromp on the gas, hit Sherwin, knock him down, and run over him and kill him. Maybe I didn't intend to kill him, but I did. Sherwin's dead. Now let's suppose on that same day, you're driving home and in Arizona, sometimes when thunderstorms occur, they're preceded by dust storms, and that's happening, and it's getting hard to see, and it's blowing, and you say, hey, I better pay attention to my driving. So you slow down, and you're doing everything you can do to be the best driver you can. You're concentrating on your driving, and you're driving responsibly. And as you pass a parked truck, some pedestrian, some drunk, we'll say, just lurches out in front of you. You can't stop in time. You put your foot on the brake, but you hit him and kill him. Now, what do we have? We have two dead bodies. One's just as dead as the other. But in terms of guilt, there's a lot of difference. I am guilty of murder, premeditated to some degree. At least I meant to hurt Sherwin. Whether I meant to kill him or not is another thing. You see where I'm guilty? In your case, you're not guilty at all. That was an accident. In fact, at the very time you hit that person, you were doing everything you could reasonably do to be a good, safe, conscientious driver. You see where there's no guilt in the second case? Okay, but the guilt feelings may be all mixed up. Maybe you're so immobilized by the guilt feelings that accompany what's happened to you that you can't even get out of bed. You know, and you know the guy, and his wife is retarded, and she's unemployable, and he's got six kids, and it goes on and on and on. And you're just wallowing in this guilt feeling, huh? But there's no real guilt there. Do you get the difference? In my case, I may be so screwed up or so hardened that I don't feel guilty at all. You know, I feel, you know, you guys get together, we're going to have an award banquet for me for getting rid of germs. Put a plaque on the wall for what a great service I've done. Now, the point that I want to make that has helped me a great deal is I have discovered that in my life I am addicted to guilt feelings. They have become habitual with me. Somehow I get off on guilt feelings. And it's a waste of time, it's a waste of energy, it's a waste of life. So it's a good inventory item to separate the guilt in your life. See, because if you're really guilty of something and you're working this program, you have a way to deal with that. You admit that you're wrong, you become willing to make amends, you ask forgiveness, and you get on with life. If you got a whole bunch of guilt feelings, all they do is breed with each other and you have a whole lot more. A lot of you are going to say, but what am I going to do if I can't feel guilty or angry or something? You know, I'll have all this time on my hands. That's all right. We'll figure out what you can do with it. Okay. Now, in the past couple of years, more has been revealed to me about this same subject, because where first I just labeled both guilt and guilt feelings guilt, in fact, I think I mentioned that to you sometime on the retreat, that when I was drinking, I thought I was crazy, and the diagnosis I came up with was that I suffered from excessive guilt. Okay, in a lecture, somebody once said, about 8 years into sobriety, is this listing symptoms of alcoholism, chronic guilt feelings was one of them. I wish I would have heard that guy earlier. So there's really something there, but there's a whole other area that, because I could not distinguish between my feelings, I didn't know how to do that, I confused another thing. I'll just put a question mark up on the board here. I confused this other reality with guilt and guilt feelings, because it kind of went in that area. So there are three categories here. One is guilt. Put that next to the smokers. Guilt feelings. And this other area that I want to talk about right now. By the way, guilt can be used as a verb, too. That helps you get a handle on it, too. You ever been guilted? Okay. Some people can guilt you better than others. My mother, who I dearly love, when she was alive, could guilt me so quick. You know, and she did it slick, you know, because she was happy that I was a priest. But she would overdo that thing, you know. It was so wonderful, all the good work I was doing. You know, she knew I was conducting a retreat for 100 alcoholics, she'd tell the neighbors, my son is sobering up Phoenix, or, you know, just jump to the next level. She would believe if Jesus Christ had a problem, I could help. Okay. I don't know what that does to you. It makes me feel guilty. Okay? And that comes from a lot of our authority figures and parental type people in our lives. Parents first, mom and dad, but other authority figures. And that other authority figure, that little parent that lives within each of us, a lot of trouble with them, too. Anyway, I want to talk more about this. And I want to make about three points here that I know for some of you will be brand new information. About a year and a half ago, I called my mother at 5 o'clock in the morning. She lived in Indiana. And I said, Mom, I'm taking a course, a week-long workshop on family dynamics. And I'm doing a lot of studying about our family. and I have some questions about it. Do you mind if I ask you some questions about our family? He says, no, that's my favorite topic. I said, well, some of them might be a little painful because there's some things I don't understand and I can't even talk about them without, I think, upsetting you. Would that be okay if I did that? She says, sure, go ahead. So I said, do you think Dad was an alcoholic? Now, what happened at that moment was I felt I had committed murder long distance. You know, because there was dead silence on the other end of the, you know, and I thought there was a dead mother in Indiana someplace. And she said, of course not. Now, the reason I'd never asked that question is simply because there's a large mythic, and I don't mean by unreal, but proportion, a story bigger than the story itself. You know what a myth is in that sense? Anyway, there's a story, a true story in our family that's reached heroic proportions. And it's the fact that my dad, who had a lot of physical problems, really worshiped this doctor that he had. And one day the doctor said, Bill, if you don't quit smoking and you don't quit drinking, you find another doctor. And my dad quit smoking and quit drinking on the same day. And never drank and never smoked again. And I can't relate to that. So you see why I'd never ask a question like that? But there were some things that were going on in our family that looked pretty alcoholic to me. Not in my dad as much as in some of the rest of us. So that's why I got courage enough to ask the question. And Mom said, in answer to the question, do you think Dad's an alcoholic? Why, of course not. And then she said, but he certainly had a drinking problem. And then my mother describes to me over the phone what you and I know as alcoholism. I didn't tell her that I thought that spelled alcoholism. I didn't need to. But she talked about a personality change. She talked about being vindictive. She talked about being so embarrassed because when he'd be entertaining company, he'd start stories and exaggerate and get real grandiose. And Mom said, I couldn't go into the kitchen because I had to stay there to listen to the story. Otherwise, I'd come in and contradict something he just said with the truth. I suppose a lot of people hearing that information would be terribly upset. I was relieved because it made sense out of a whole lot of things in my life that hadn't made sense before. And then the next thing even surprised me because I heard my mouth say, do you think Dad was too friendly with the neighbor lady? I mentioned her name. The best way to describe that neighbor lady would be to say that she was very, very sexy. I don't know about you, but when puberty happened to me, it attacked. One day I was a little boy and the next day I've got hormones running all over the place. And I don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden I noticed the neighbor lady. And my parents were, I think I was about 12 at that time, I don't know. My parents were complimenting me on doing homework and working so hard. What that had to do with was I could do the homework at the kitchen table and look out the window and watch the neighbor lady garden. And if I was lucky, she'd go empty the garbage. She would go for the mail. You get the picture. You know what that's like. She's the kind of woman that if she walked by out there right now, every guy would notice and every woman would pretend not to. And hate her. Okay? You got it? That's what she looked like. Anyway. Boy, you think it was quiet the first time. When my mom finally spoke again, here's what she said. She said, finally I have someone to talk to about that. And just relief on her part. And I saw my mother twice before she passed away. Both times for a couple of days at a time, and we had the best conversations that we ever had. And we talked about things I never thought I could talk about with my mom. It was wonderful. Now, I want to introduce this idea with some of that material, this third category here of something that I lumped with guilt and guilt feelings, but is very, very different and very tricky and elusive and slippery, but also enormously powerful, and I believe today a major part of every alcoholic's life. If you study family dynamics and you study alcoholic family dynamics, you realize that what happens in the life of an alcoholic is that he's not dealing with things when they happen. And as a result, the family gets so confused because of the arbitrary behavior in the alcoholic, they kind of postpone what they're going to do and how they're going to feel and what they're going to think until they see what kind of a mood the alcoholic is in. So they're kind of on hold. And they're just kind of waiting there. Now, some of you know a good friend of mine named Tom Weston. He tells a wonderful story about a rhinoceros. Sometimes he talks about an elephant, but anyway, let's stay with the rhinoceros. And he said, I grew up in a home where we had a rhinoceros in the living room. Great big beast, just stood there and kind of grunted. And the family rule was you had to pretend it wasn't there. And everybody tippy-toed around it, and every now and then we threw a tablecloth over it. But for no apparent reason, at unscheduled moments, they'd go on a rampage and just charge around the house and tear things up. And at that point, everyone was supposed to, they knew what they were supposed to do. They threw themselves against the wall in the form of a cross and waited for the beast to quiet down. But you still couldn't talk about it. Because the other family rule was, if you said anything about the rhinoceros, you had to clean up the mess. What a wonderful description of alcoholism, huh? A marvelous description. Some treatment center in the California area has picked that up and made a commercial out of it, and they actually have a live elephant in a living room, and everyone's pretending it's not there. It's just hilarious to watch the thing. And as a result of that, someone has done a little book for children to explain alcoholism about the elephant in our living room, and it is just powerful the way it works. Anyway, what happens in the families of alcoholics is that their feelings become frozen. There's a film that I like. It's out of date. It's made by the National Film Board of Canada called The Summer We Moved to Elm Street. And it just documents a little girl, Doreen, who's 11 years old, and you just watch her shut down and become a non-participant in life. And she becomes such a non-participant that she watches a little girlfriend of hers drowned, and she doesn't go for help because she just is shut down. So alcoholism has to do with frozen or delayed feelings. Even alcoholics do that too. They have wonderful feelings, and we're not real spontaneous, except with our character defects. They're kind of ahead of time. But with anything that's appropriate, we're about a day late. You know, the picnic's over with, and all of a sudden you decide to get happy and show up. Why isn't everybody having a good time here? Well, they had a good time yesterday. They're worn out. No. Anyway. There's another point that I want to make about feelings, which sounds bizarre. But let me give you the example of it first. What prompted this question to my mother more than anything else is this. I came across my dad and the neighbor lady, who was a best friend of the family of my mom. She was kind of like a grandmother type. Anyway, I came across my dad and the neighbor lady in a real compromising position one day, fondling each other. And I have to remember how I grew up. In some of your homes, I guess that'd be okay, but I don't know, but it sure wasn't in mine. So I was pretty well brainwashed in a Catholic morality, the flavor of which everything was black or white. There was no gray. And, you know, so the world looked like this. Everything here is black and everything is white. And you put everything into one of those two categories. The amazing thing was, as I got out into the world on my own, I found that there was a much wider range, and that the black part of life was maybe 10%, and over here on the other end, there's 10% that's white. In the middle, that leaves about 80% that's gray. Now, even today, I operate at near perfect efficiency in the black and the white area. I'm not worth diddly in the gray stuff. I don't know what to do. I get lost there and just fumble around and stumble all over the place. Some of you are pretty good with the gray stuff, and I admire you and follow you around. So what I see with this woman that I respect and love and is a family friend, and my dad who I idolize, is some behavior that in my head, according to my training, definitely goes in the black area. Are we all together at this point? But what actually happened at that point, since I idolized my dad, and this neighbor lady was someone who was a good person, who the whole family liked, was at that particular moment, something happened to me. You see, my dad and the neighbor lady at that point are acting shamelessly because they made a joke out of it and they kind of laughed it off. So they're really not dealing with their own shame. Guess who picked up the shame? I felt really rotten. I felt, now this isn't logical, but I felt that what was going on was my fault. Now, I don't understand that in the sense of linear logic, but it makes sense in my gut. So the name of this third category here is called shame. And shame is very different than guilt. Guilt has to do with behavior, what you do or what you don't do. Shame has to do with who you are. If shame had a voice, it would say things like this to you: you're really no good. You're a bad boy. You're rotten. You're really lazy. You'll never get it right. Suppose I came in here this morning to give this talk and I was listening to my shame, it would be saying something like, you really should have prepared better. Or let's take the example of where I come to do a presentation like this and I've prepared really well. The shame will still talk to me. And at the last minute it's going to say, you'll find a way to screw it up. You know how to blow it. Sound familiar? Okay, now there are some people today, we're really gun-shy for trying to figure out what the causes of alcoholism are, because most people who do that don't help people recover very well. But more and more people today are talking about alcoholism as being shame-based. That it's essentially tied together, whatever alcoholism is, with this, it's more than low self-esteem, it's self-condemnation, it's worthlessness. And it's a conviction of that that's real deep within alcoholics. Now, whether that's there at the beginning and helps cause it, or whether it's there when it happens, I know for sure it's there afterwards. And it will feed everything that will destroy our serenity, our program, our contentment after we've been sober for a while. So it's an amazing, powerful thing. Let me say a couple more things about shame. Let me go to denial. Denial and shame go hand in hand. Denial is one of those things that's instantaneous, that's quick. It's faster than logic. Did I use the example yesterday about the woman whose husband shot up the apartment? Yeah, okay. You know, that illogic, that convincing but untrue statement of hers, I should really count my blessings, was so quick and so instantaneous and so convincing that denial has that nature. So the denial feeds the shame feeds the denial. Shame is quick, but what makes shame even more difficult and slippery is the primary quality of shame is it's ashamed and it wants to hide and it doesn't want you to know it's there. So you kind of get a handle on it and it's gone, it's elusive. I want to do something now, particularly those who are listening, for those who are listening on tape, but also for those here. And if I'd known I was going to do this, I would have done it earlier. And it'll get you in touch with the shame in your life, and then you'll know what I'm talking about. Now, I would have ideally done this at 3 or 4 different sessions, but let me run you through the process. And I beg of you to try it. You know, once you hear it, you'll know what the conclusion's going to be. And then you say, well, I understand that. But you won't understand it the way you would have if you had done the exercise and experienced it on a feeling level. What I would want you to do in the first session is to come up with three statements that begin with the words, I am. And then fill in one word after I am that's negative. So I want you to be able to, and I'm not asking anybody to share this or say it out loud, but to be able to say the three crummiest things about yourself that you can think of. So I am ugly, I am rotten, I'm no good, I'm sleazy, I'm a perfectionist, you know, whatever it is. But you have to spend a little time with that because it's going to be different for each person. And when you get it, you know it because it's going to be familiar to you. Whatever it is. So that's what you would do, and I'd say take a couple of hours or half a day just to get familiar with that. So you got those three negative I am statements. Then later, when you want to do the second thing, and if you do this with someone else, don't tell them what the steps are ahead of time. Let them experience the feelings that go with each section. What you do is you extend this list from 3 to 20. So you come up with 20 I am statements that are negative about yourself. And if you don't think you can do that, I'll help you. Because anybody can do it. Okay. Now, here comes the hard part. There's a lot of pain involved in this already. But here comes the hard part. What you do next is, opposite those 20 negative I am statements, you write I am, and you put in a positive word. And you do this mechanically. Whatever the negative statement is, you put the opposite positive thing there, even though you don't want to do it. So if you said, suppose you're always late for things, huh? And the way you express that is, I am tardy. So the opposite of that would be to say, I am prompt. Now, no matter how tardy you are, once in a while you show up on time. So there's some truth in the fact that you're prompt. You've been prompt twice in your life. So there's some truth there. You put that down. You get the idea? It's going to be hard because you don't want to do it. So you feel like you're cheating. So if you've written down there, I am ugly, you write down, I am beautiful. You get the opposite, and you do that mechanically. So what we now have is a list of 20 positive I am statements. Are we together on the process? Okay. Then what you do, and a lot of you are going to fall by the wayside here because it's embarrassing. Then what you do is you get a tape recorder and you record onto tape those 20 positive statements. And I feel badly because this is letting the cat out of the bag. But if you don't tell people about this part ahead of time, it's one. In fact, those of you who are hesitant to do this, I'll challenge you. Go through this exercise with somebody and just do it a step at a time, and then you can watch it happen and then. You record those 20 positive statements on that tape. And what you do is you play it back. And you know what you're going to hear? Inevitably, you're going to hear this thin, weak, timid, shy little voice saying, I am beautiful. I'm prompt. Yeah. Would not convince a worm. Huh? And then you get in touch with this shame stuff. You see how powerful it is. The next step is to keep re-recording that till you get it where it sounds convincing. You know, I am beautiful. It's going to take a while to do this. The one that just turned me into knots was, I forget what the negative thing was I had on my list. Something about, I am worthless. And when I went through the positive stuff, I wrote down worthless, I put down precious. Well, guys don't talk that way, you know. When I come to say that on the table, I said, I am. And it took me about 3 minutes because I am. you know, and finally this weak little boy, I am precious. But I finally got to the point where I could say, I am precious. And so are you. You know, all you have to do is watch, you know, Mimi has that beautiful little baby. And if you hang around with that little baby for a while, and even the big macho guys in the group will, you know, do that and go coochie coochie coo and make fools out of themselves and all that. But we all know how precious that little child is. You know, the potential and what a miracle it is. Well, just because you grew up, you were like that at one time, you're just as you're more precious today. But it's hard to admit that. When you do this, you get in touch with the power that shame has over you. If you want some theory to go with this, what you're coming up with is positive self-talk. Because in our lives, we have negative self-talk that's going on all the time, that's kind of tearing us down. Pardon me. So what you do after you get this tape is you come up with some positive self-talk, and you listen to it very attentively in the morning and at night, like you believe it. You know, I'm worthwhile, I'm a good person, I'm beautiful, I'm healthy, I'm generous. And it's wonderful, because it's true. It's part of truth that alcoholism has denied us access to. So I recommend it highly. And for a long time around AA and Al-Anon, I didn't want to talk about shame because it sounded pretty theoretical and pretty treatment-oriented and all of that kind of stuff. But I want to talk about it around AA and Al-Anon now because I can't wait to see what happens when the awareness... You know, the book says we only know a little. We know only a little. You know, as we learn more and more about the face of the enemy... So if you want some principles involved here, shame in an alcoholic family, feelings are borrowed. You don't even have your own. Somebody's got some negative feelings in the family they don't want to deal with. Somebody there is going to be dumb enough to volunteer to take them on. You know, that's what Al-Anons are trying to recover from. Huh? I'll help you. I'll take care of all your negative feelings and beat myself up. Which means you deprive the person of the consequences of their own behavior. They go scot-free thinking everything's wonderful while they continue to wreak havoc on the world and themselves. And you just beat yourself up and immobilize yourself with a bunch of crummy feelings that you don't have any right to, that you don't deserve to feel, because they're not yours. Does that sound too far-fetched? Okay, good. What I can't wait for is to see what program people do with that kind of information and insight when we apply folksy AA wisdom to it. Because there's nothing like folksy AA wisdom. I mean, you can't buy it anywhere else. You get answers from program people that you don't get anywhere else. When I went to Hazleton about 3 months ago and we were lining up this sabbatical, they asked me a couple of things. They said, what do you really want to study while you're back here? And I said, for sure I want to study family dynamics, and I really want to study shame because I'm convinced of its existence in all alcoholics, and I've read the literature, and everything I've read is technical and academic. And I'd really like to study it well enough, maybe with some of your long-term shame-filled patients, to and they said, they interrupted right there and said, we got a whole wing of those guys there, and you're welcome to them. I said, to the point where I could write a popular article about it or something. And they said, hey, that's terrific. Well, what they didn't tell me is I was leaving Hazleton, I went through their bookstore, and they had a new pamphlet out called Shame-Faced, written by Stephanie E. She wrote it anonymously. And I got on the airplane, and I had my little highlighter, you know, and I'm underlining everything in yellow that impressed me. I went into hysterics the next day because I could have dipped the damn book in a yellow bucket of paint. I think it's one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen. We have them up in the gift shop. They're only, what, $250 or something like that? Shame-Faced. I'll try to bring one to the next session and to lunch, but she's got incredible program, helps get you in touch with the reality of shame, and gives you all kinds of practical program ways to address it. I've not gotten as excited about a pamphlet or a book in a long, long time as I have. I've got to meet Stephanie. I don't know where she lives, but so nothing ever works out the way we think it's gonna. growing up means being willing to be rid of our old ideas, to admit that things aren't working out the way we think they should have or ought to, but we're still alive and we need to deal with life and with the people in our lives today the way they are and where we are. And what makes that all so wonderful is that in the dark part of that growth process, when we don't know what's going on, there's still a loving God that I really believe is present to us that will give us the power and the strength whenever we ask for it to deal with any of these real tricky, painful areas. I know I'm excited about the work that I've done in this area, and I'll continue to share whatever it is that I've learned about it. We've got a chance for a nice long break. Let's be back here. Well, lunch is at 12:30. Let's be present and ready to go at 11:15. How's that?